All right, what is up, everybody? Welcome back. My name is Bruce. This is the Life After Army podcast. It has been a little bit of time, not too much, but what some of y'all may notice is there's video on this one again. We're getting back into it a little bit. We're going to try it out. And if you haven't seen a video in a little while, you're going to notice this sweet facial accessory that I've been sporting for a little while now that we are wearing masks and COVID. It'll probably stick around till the end of masks, and then I think it'll go away. Because if you want people to stay 6 feet away from you, just grow a mustache as amazing as this. I never really grew one before, because in the Army, they're pretty sticklers on it. You can't really grow the little handlebars like this, but it's pretty awesome. Also, if you'll notice, we'll see. The title of this podcast may be Too Close for Missiles, Switching to Guns. If it's not that, whatever, doesn't matter. But we're going to talk about which weapon system on the AH-64 you might use and why. Now, this is going to be just a couple of dudes talking at the tail of the helicopter, just like you'd do a brief. We're not going to get into the weeds. It's no 5 and 9. I'm not going to pull out a bunch of nomenclature. Because one, I've probably forgot a lot of it. If you don't use it every day, it's easy to forget. You don't remember those kind of things. There's a reason we put all this information in books. But we're going to talk from a practical sense, from someone who's been there, why you might pick a weapon system and use it over another one. Because you've got a few to choose from on the Apache. So if that's something that interests you, grab a cup of coffee. Finish mowing the lawn, go for a run, because we're going to talk about this. We'll see how long it takes. I don't know, but we'll see. So, a couple things. If you're not familiar with the AH-64, there are three weapon systems on the helicopter, one being a 30mm chain gun, which is amazing. The other, probably a little more familiar to most people, the AGM-114 Hellfire missile, of which there are several types of missiles you can shoot. We'll talk about a few of those. I've shot several different kinds in combat. There are many variants out there, especially with the proliferation of UAS and UAVs, etc., and some more capable missiles than we had when this thing was originally developed. And then, last but not least, the 2.75-inch folding fin aerial rocket, the Hydra 70, which comes in several different flavors as well, and why you might use a few of them. And in reality, I've only used a few types in combat. Let's see. Commonly known as the 10-pounder with a super quick fuse. If you know the nomenclature of these, that's fine. I do. But at the same time, like, if I tell you an M51 warhead, 151 warhead with a M423 super quick fuse, it's going to roll in one ear and right out the other. So we're just going to call it the 10-pounder. Shot that one in combat several times. Flechettes, used those several times to great effect. Overt and covert alums, we'll kind of talk about those a little bit as well and when you would use those and why you might use one or the other. And let's see, I've carried white phosphorus, never used it in combat. We've also had what is referred to as the area point kill weapon system, which is a rocket with a laser guided strap-on unit to it to make it essentially a small guided munition at this point. We carried them. I have shot a few of them in training, but I didn't use them in combat. And we'll talk about a little bit of that, hopefully, later on, if I can remember. They were used to great effect in Afghanistan. We did not use them because of the environment we're in. One more reason why you might choose one weapon system over the other, but we'll talk about it a little bit. I never actually shot them in combat. One and two a few times, but it just didn't seem like there was a better weapon system to use. But let's talk about some of the factors that you would consider when you're choosing, why would you go missiles, why would you go guns, or maybe shoot rockets. One, what kind of target are you shooting at? And so let's take the current conflict. I was in Afghanistan on my two deployments, and so your typical target is going to be personnel in the open, thin-skinned vehicles, Toyota Hiluxes, etc. Great Hellfire target, by the way. Motorcycles, huts, and when I say huts, like a kalats, a actually sometimes pretty thick mud building, and hellfires may or may not be effective against it. We did run into bunkers, like earthen World War I trench style bunkers in Afghanistan this last time. What you might or might not be able to employ against it, especially with a hellfire missile with 18 pounds of high explosive on it, may or may not penetrate it, depending on which one you're shooting. And so, as far as type of target, you don't see armored targets in Afghanistan anymore to any real degree. You'll see some old Russian hulks out there, as far as some old Russian tanks that have since been destroyed well before my time and are resting in peace out there. But you have no reason to shoot them. They aren't shooting back. Well, let's talk about this. So, personnel in the open. If you just put a dude out in the middle of a field, any one of those weapon systems is going to work extremely well against it. Why would you choose one versus the other? Well, the 30mm types of weapon system, the 30mm and the Hydra 70 rocket is definitely an area weapon system, whereas a Hellfire or an APKWS is a point weapon system. So unless the missile malfunctions, it is going to go where you are designating and hit that spot. So if you're worried about collateral damage, CIVCAS, civilian casualties, if you're shooting in a city, those are important things to take into consideration because you are not there to hurt the civilian populace in any way. In fact, you're there to help as much as you can. And so you don't want to hurt people who are innocently in the area. It's amazing, side tangent, how much normalcy goes on in what you would consider a combat zone, a war zone. I can remember some of my first flights in country. I was amazed how many people were just out doing normal things. But it makes complete sense. They've been essentially doing this for thousands of years and anywhere else. Same Syria. Life has to go on. And so you are there to engage lawful combatants. You don't want to hurt the civilian populace. In fact, that does more harm than good, not only physically to them, but in just your cause. You start hurting the civilians, they stop helping you. So it behooves you to be extremely good with what you're trying to use to engage lawful combatants. Other things that are going to go into it, as we said, type of target, collateral damage considerations, CIVCAS, where are you currently at, like how rapidly do you need to engage, weather conditions could play into it, and also local tactical directives by your chain of command. They may say you cannot use this certain type of weapon system in this scenario. So that could be a thing. The other thing, the ground force commander, JTAC, or Private Joe Snuffy on the ground, could request a certain weapon system. He may say one by Hellfire. And 90% of the time, you'll probably agree with him. You'll go, okay, that works out great. But if you know something else is going to work, or you know you can't use that weapon system due to one of those factors, you may recommend something else. Because ultimately, whatever you release off that aircraft, it's your responsibility. I know they say the ground force commander owns it when he requests it and gives you clearance to engage, but it is your job. And they are certainly going to come calling and asking questions to you. So let's talk about a few things. And some of this goes into weaponeering along with gunner tactics and how you might employ it. So we're going to back it up slightly. If we're thinking about targets, personnel in the open, any one of those weapon systems worked. I've used 30 millimeters, I've used Hellfires and rockets on personnel in the open. They all work great. Some are easier to use than others. And quite simply, the 30 millimeter is probably the quickest to engage because you can use so many different sights. You're just your basic gunner helmet sight. You can look at it literally with your eyeballs, pull the trigger. And if you've got your range and a few other ballistic factors figured out, you're probably going to hit the target. So it's pretty nice to be able to action the weapon, look at the target, pull the trigger, and boom, it's done. That's great. You don't have to put the helicopter in any kind of specific orientation, and that applies more so to missiles and rockets. And let's talk about that a little bit. Let's go talk about the AGM-114 Hellfire missile. Several different flavors. And we'll kind of go back a little bit and talk why it was developed. And so the Apache and that Hellfire missile were originally intended to stop the Russian horde coming across Western Europe and stopping armored advances. And so if you Google a Hellfire engagement or a Hellfire missile shot on YouTube, Google, I don't know, you can find some come up. You'll see this missile comes off the rail. It's not that exciting, actually, in the helicopter. It does what we refer to as a G-bias climb. So it pitches up at a constant G for the missile. And then it starts to pitch over in this parabolic flight. And so if you're listening to this, you're missing out my amazing hand gestures as I show this. But anyway, a G-bias climb, it climbs up real high because it wants to be able to look down. And it's looking for your laser energy that is being designated from the helicopter. It also climbs for another reason, and that is because it wants to defeat tank armor. And tank armor on the top of the tank is usually less than the sides or the front. And so if you want to have the most probability of kill, mobility kill, firearm kill, etc., or just completely destroy the vehicle, you want to hit it in its weak spots. And so that's what the missile is designed to do. It is a tandem shape charge dual warhead with about 18,000 pounds. God, that'd be a big missile. 18 pounds to 20 pounds, depending on the variant of a high explosive. And so there's a reason also why it has a dual shape charge warhead in it. In the front of the missile, you have a seeker that's watching your laser energy. Where does this missile want to go? It's looking for it. Then if you look at a Hellfire missile, you'll notice there are two yellow bands. Well, those bands designate where the high explosive are in that missile. And there's two of them. So the first one is designed to defeat armor, specifically reactive armor. And so the first shape charge will defeat the armor. The second shape charge will send that molten metal straight through the tank hull and destroying equipment and personnel inside. So there's definitely a method to the madness when it comes to this. And so originally, like I said, since it was designed to destroy armor, and then fast forward to us in Afghanistan, we're shooting these things at personnel in the open. One to take your pick of how many people you're trying to engage. If you shoot this missile and it hits at their feet, they're probably done. Short answer. But if you don't hit quite near them perfectly, or you have others around there that you're also trying to engage, you need the fragmentation effect, which is where the missile really lacked in ability. And so, let's see. Now, we're going to refer to a few model missiles here. Fox, Fox Alpha, Kilo 2 Alpha, November, and Lima. Lima is just an interesting one. But anyway, and so what I just described to you was essentially a Fox model missile. Two shaped warheads, two tandem shaped charge warheads, 18 pounds of explosive, but no significant blast fragmentation sleeve for any spalling effect to engage people around the impact area. And so that's important because if you take your job relatively serious as an Apache gunner, in which I think every one of them do, you'll be pretty familiar with the fragmentation pattern when a missile hits the ground at an angle of somewhere between probably about 30 to 90 degrees, depending on how steeply it is coming down. And usually in a direction of travel, it goes out in like a butterfly pattern. And so if you've listened to a few of the other podcasts before, you might have heard me talk about them putting the target on a platter. And this is, we're talking about personnel. And in fact, if you go back some of my earliest videos, and they're kind of hard to watch, but kind of fast forward through there, you'll see as I talk about the crosshairs of the target, if you have the horizontal bar and you put it at the feet of the target, the person, and if that missile hits at their feet and this butterfly spall fragmentation effect goes out and forward, you have the most probability of incapacitating that target. And so that's, that in this case, is the goal. I know it's kind of macabre, but backing it up a step again, I mentioned a few different models of missiles. Fox, Fox Alpha. Well, that A, when I say Alpha, is important because we went to Afghanistan. Not a lot of armored shoot there, which is good for us as Apache pilots. I didn't want to have to go up against armor too much. That would have been kind of scary. But we did need fragmentation effect. And so the A designated that they'd added a blast fragmentation sleeve around the warhead section of the Hellfire missile. And so they scored. At this point, it's a couple different materials. I don't remember exactly what it is. But anyway, they put a metal sleeve around the warhead and they scored it. So when that warhead went off, it shot all these chunks of steel out from the missile. So you had much greater fragmentation effect, much better against anti-personnel. And so the probability of kill went up for shooting personnel in the open. And we did that to great effect often. And so, because oftentimes you needed a point weapon system if you were in a city, a town, etc. Your desire is not necessarily to blow up the person and everything around them. You need a point weapon system. So we'll kind of talk about one of the factors I didn't mention earlier is getting the aircraft, or I kind of did a little bit, is getting the aircraft in a position to use that weapon system quickly and effectively. Missiles require very specific constraints, and that is a technical term per se, to be in, to shoot. And when I say constraints, you have to be within a certain altitude, airspeed, and azimuth from the target to be able to use that missile and have a, we're going for about a 90% probability of kill, probability of hit. If you go outside of that, your chances go down greatly. The further you are outside of it, the further your chances diminish. And that is because a missile can only maneuver to a certain extent. If you've ever watched a movie and you've seen missiles chase targets, that just doesn't happen. If it goes past your designated line of sight where you're lasing, the missile just keeps flying. If it loses your laser, it just keeps flying. It doesn't turn around and look for you. It's not some Roger Rabbit cartoon and come back and actively seek the target. So you have to put the missile in a certain window for you to have a high probability of hit. And generally, that's usually about 30 degrees off the target, off the nose. So if you're further than, if your nose is pointed more than 30 degrees off the, from the target, you won't be in constraints. The missile is not going to fire. In fact, the Apache has restrictions that if you pull the trigger, you can pull it a second time, the missile will leave the rail. But it'll prevent you from firing it. Essentially, it's like a, hey, dummy, you're not in constraints. There is a lot of graphical representation. And if you're listening to this, I don't know, even on the video, I don't have the weapon symbology to show you right now. In some of my previous videos, you can see where I specifically talk about missile engagements, the constraints box, when it goes solid, it gets real big in your screen. You're in constraints, clear to fire, pull the trigger, keep designating until impact. And so various missiles from the Fox model have the tightest constraints as far as you have to be further from the target, you have a narrower azimuth range, and so it limits you as far as how quickly you can engage because you have to put the helicopter in constraints. The Kilo 2 Alpha, much like the Fox Alpha, there's some upgraded guidance section, essentially went from an analog guidance section to a digital guidance section so we could get much closer to the target. And as close as 500 meters, in fact, which is impressive because that is an extremely close missile shot. By the time the missile leaves the rail, it's there that quick. And so that helped tremendously. And so same thing, dual shape charge warhead, blast fragmentation sleeve. But your constraints window was bigger, so you had more freedom to maneuver and you could get that missile off the rail in tighter constraints. It was great. We'll talk about Novembers a little bit. And this goes back to your target. What are you shooting? And so I mentioned culottes earlier. And so a culotte is essentially a mud house you're going to find everywhere in Afghanistan. Walls can be anywhere from a foot to several feet thick. And a typical Hellfire missile, Fox or Kilo 2 Alpha, even with two shaped charged warheads, they have super quick fuses. And so as soon as that nose hits something, boom, it goes off. Which is great if you're trying to punch through armor. But when you're trying to punch through 1 to 3 feet of building, it's not. The missile just explodes on the outside. It may knock the wall down, but the effects you're trying to get on the inside of the building are negligible. And so if personnel are inside the building shooting out, you obviously, it's just, it doesn't work so great. So the November model missile was great. It was what we generally refer to as a thermobaric metal augmented charge. And so think of it as a fuel air bomb with a delay fuse. So if you need to punch through a building, any kind of building, really, specifically, I'm going to refer to a culotte. You'd pick a line of sight on the wall somewhere where the structure seemed to be weakest or you needed the most target effects. So don't pick like a corner where you're going to have a significant buildup of mud, structure, or other things that might prevent the missile from going through the wall. You don't want to blaze into a window either and just be like, I'm going to put this missile through that window. Because you're gonna, the missile is going to lose the laser energy through the window into the house, and it's not going to track to your target. So you have to have it essentially against a flat surface or a surface that the missile can see. So you can't put it into a window. Because it'd be like, yeah, just shoot through a window. That'd be great. No, I wish. It's happened by accident before. A lot of times, the flat surface of a roof is ideal. If you can, if it's a one-room culotte, or if you know specifically which windows and room you're trying to engage, because they might be on the top floor of a two-story culotte, put it through the roof in that room. It's generally a lot thinner because it can't be as heavy. Otherwise, it'd have to have a lot more structure to support it. So they're generally thinner. So put missiles through roofs works really well. But that November model missile with a metal augmented charge will punch through with a delay fuse, and then once it's through the wall, as I said, it's essentially a fuel air bomb. So take a, I don't know the exact mixture, but just essentially, it's probably a lot of aluminum and other material metals. Blows it all outward, and then it just rapidly expands as it all ignites. You create a significant overpressure in the building, generally a lot of times leading to a full collapse of the walls. And then what happens inside, if your body is exposed to such a rapid overpressure, it just destroys your body. It destroys whatever's inside. And so if you want to destroy the building and you want to neutralize whatever targets inside, people in there shooting out, it's an excellent option. And so in theater, a lot of these missiles... And these things don't just grow on trees either. We got to a point on our second deployment. We shot so many missiles, we were literally running out of certain types. And a lot of them were being diverted to other theaters. Because you got to think, there are a lot of hotspots in the world. Africa, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. And there's a lot of aviation assets out there. And more are using the Hellfire missile, specifically UAV platforms. And a lot of the newer Hellfire platforms that have... essentially can turn around 180 degrees, shoot extremely far off axis, etc., are going to UAVs because they fly higher. The missile has more time to maneuver and retain energy. And so a lot of these Novembers, Romeos, Papas, Papa Pluses, you name it, we're going to those platforms. We are getting a lot of, especially, we pretty much shot all Fox Alphas the second deployment. We had some thermobarics early, some Novembers, but we used them, and then that was it. They were gone. And so when it comes to missiles and targets, that I hope that kind of explains Fox model missiles, great for armor. not so great for personnel, because the person, if you don't hit near them, they may be exposed to the blast. Obviously, it's going to ring their bell, but it may not kill them. Fox Alpha is much better against anti-personnel, still great against armor. Kilo 2 Alphas, great against armor and personnel with a wider engagement envelope, so you can be much closer to the target, which is nice. Coffee's good. I need it. That's another problem. Mustache problems right here. I tend to save coffee and other stuff for later in it, so I got to double check. So let me look. How to look. Any coffee in the mustache? Okay. Otherwise, we're going to come back to 30 millimeter. Let's talk about rockets for a second. Rockets are extremely fun to shoot. They're difficult to shoot. There's several different ways you can shoot them. Not everybody was created equal when it comes to them, because there were times I'd be like, let's engage with rockets, but you knew gun 2 just wasn't very good at shooting them. So you're like, maybe we should use another weapon system. I've used 10 pounders, so essentially there's about 8-point-something pounds of high explosive in there, fragmentation effects off of it. Good. I forget out the radius, but it's pretty big blast radius. If you're near it, it's definitely going to ring your bell and rock your socks. Flechettes, very interesting rocket. Been around forever. I've used them in combat to pretty good effect. But there are... And this number is very odd, so I always remember it. And it's something people always ask you, like, how many flechettes are in a rocket? Well, there's 1,179 of those things in each rocket. It was funny because they would always ask us that. And I'm like, really? You think there's 1,179 in every one of those? Not like 1,180 or 1,178 in a few of them. But they were always like, how many flechettes are in there? And these things are 60 grain darts. Literally look like a dart. Man. For you video viewers out there, I don't have my flechette around here right now. I need to get my 30 millimeter case out here too, so y'all can see that. But think, I mean, just picture a dart. Make it all steel. Weigh 60 grains. That's a flechette. It's a mean looking little thing. And when there's 1,179 of them, ooh. And so the idea, there's a term called the beaten zone. And that is essentially the impact area and the beaten area the weapon is going to effectively engage. So if you have a 30 millimeter, the beaten zone is going to be several meters around the impact area. Well, a flechette is designed to put essentially one of these nails in a square meter. Oh man, I forget what distance it covers. It's a, oh geez, some of you Apache guys out there, put it in the comments. But if you were at all accurate with them, chances are you're going to put one or two of these nails in the target you're looking at. And it's an anti-personnel weapon. Because a 60 grain nail, 60 grain bullet, like a 5.56 round that the Army uses is 55 grains, and they vary anyway. So you can think of it like a 5.56 round. It's pretty effective. Now, just trying to think here what we want to talk about this as. So anyway, I have fired these. I have used them against personnel. They do work great. But before we get to that, let's talk about shooting rockets. Some of the factors you're going to consider when you shoot them and why you might choose to use another weapon system or the rockets for that effect. It is definitely an aerial weapon system. It is great for personnel in the open, specifically 10-pounders, flechettes. That's really all I've shot in anger in combat, other than looms, but we're not shooting looms at people on the ground. It's just ridiculous. But yeah, so there's a couple ways you can shoot them, and I'm going to explain it. Fixed rockets first. So if you didn't know, if you look at an Apache with a rocket pod, that rocket pod can articulate up and down. You can fix it forward, or you can fix it in a ground stow position. That ground stow position is primarily there so that when armament personnel reload your rockets, they can put it in ground stow. It levels the rocket pod with the ground so that they can easily slide rockets in and out of the tube. You can shoot it like that, and I've shot rockets in ground stow before. It's just, you kind of got to figure it out. So shooting articulated rockets to me was a lot like a football bat. It took me a while to figure out, and I was never very good at shooting articulated rockets. Short answer is, what you want to, obviously, the nose has to be pointed at the target, but your acquisition source that was controlling the elevation of the rocket pod could be slave to several things. Your front seater could be using the TADS, the Target Acquisition Designated Sight System, to look at what you're engaging. It controls the elevation of the rocket pods based on the range he is using. If he lasers a target and looks at it, and based on the selection of rockets you have, those rocket pods will articulate up and down so that the rocket elevation is correct. So when you pull the trigger, if you're on azimuth, the rocket will go the correct range and land on a target. It presents this to you as an I-beam in the helicopter. What was difficult for me, because you can use several different sources to control the elevation of the rocket pods, and what people typically do is use their helmet mounted sight. So, generally when you shoot a target, you look at it. That makes a lot of sense, right? All right. So, you also want the nose of the helicopter to be pointed at the target because you want the rockets to go straight, not left or right. I think we can all understand this so far. So, you line the helicopter up with the target using the crosshairs on your HDU over your right eyeball. If you're all watching this on YouTube, you just saw me do some pretty sweet HDU hand signals there. You point the helicopter at the target with the line of sight reticle in your HDU, and then that should also, depending on what range source you have selected, we're just going to say it uses auto range. So whatever you look at, the helicopter generally knows how far away it is. I'm not going to get into too many specifics. If you're an Apache guy, you're like, but Bruce, like, I got it. And so while looking at the target, you also have to fly the helicopter at the target, and you're probably going to be in a shallow dive. And every time you move the helicopter, one of those variables changes, because I don't know how steady you can hold your head in a helicopter, but if you're watching this on YouTube, helicopters aren't exactly perfectly stable machines. And so that causes your I-beam that is being displayed as far as the rocket and helicopter alignment to constantly move up, down, left, and right. I equated a lot to if you shot rifles before with a scope on it. It's like turning the scope to look at the target and then moving the rifle to align with the scope. It can be done. Guys are amazing at it. It just, like I said, it was like a football bat to me. I didn't get it. What I did get was fixed rockets. This made a whole lot more sense to me because rockets go one way, straight out the front of the helicopter. And so what I would do is select fixed. The rocket pods would go to a set angle. You would still get an I-beam, but it was fixed forward. It did not move in your display. And then if you shot the rockets the same every way, like if you fixed forward and you started shooting it at 1,500 meters and stopped shooting at 1,000 meters and you shot 10-pound rockets with the right range setting, it was easy to put that circle right on the target, point the nose of the helicopter at it, pull the trigger. Made much more sense. Easy. Put the circle on the target, pull the trigger. If the rockets, you would watch them, whichever way they went, if they were off, you would correct. You just fly the helicopter, a little bit of pedal, a little bit of you turn left or right, pitch the nose up or down. Much more simple. It was easy to put a circle on the target and fly the helicopter at it, pull the trigger, rockets go. You could do it in ground stow as well. All that did was change the articulation of the rocket pod slightly lower so you didn't have to dive so steeply, depending on your range to the target. And this is why I say not everybody was created equal with rockets. I wasn't amazing rocket shot. I was pretty good. We got pretty good at it. We shot a lot in combat and we shot a lot in practice as well. And so I was very confident with my rockets. I wouldn't shoot them in a city or a town per se, just because collateral damage is almost a certainty. But if you had personnel in the open all day, every day, use rockets, they're great. We haven't really discussed the 30 millimeter though, so let's talk about it. There's two kinds of rounds the 30 millimeter shoots. The M788, which is a training practice round. It is a ballistic match for the M789 high explosive dual purpose round. And that is what you're going to shoot in combat down range. But the M788 training round is essentially and just an aluminum bullet. Think of a bullet in your head. And it looks exactly the same, except for the coloration, as an actual M789 high explosive dual purpose. But it's just a solid aluminum bullet. So if you don't hit the target, there's going to be no effects. Being a area weapon system, though, and also being designed the Apache to engage armor, the M789 high explosive dual purpose round was designed. And when we say dual purpose, we're talking armor and personnel. Extremely effective against thin-skinned vehicles like Toyota Hiluxes, BMPs, which would be a Russian personnel carrier, tanks. Yeah, to a degree, depending on what tank it is, where you hit it, especially against all the accoutrements that go on a tank. So all the sighting systems, any sight designation systems they have. If you want them to button up their hatches and get inside, absolutely super effective against those things. Will it probably kill it? I don't, yeah, probably. Depends if you hit it in the right places. A M789 can definitely disable a tank, and here's why. So in that actual bullet, so if you're not a ballistician, if you're not a shooter, the actual bullet that comes out of the front of that whole casing, it's like a Swiss watch inside. It's a little bit of a miracle to me that it actually works. So in the front of it is a fuse. Behind that fuse is a spin compensated shape charge. Let me see if I can say that again. Spin compensated shape charge. And then behind that is 0.79 ounces of high explosive PBXN, I think. Golly, the fact that I remember that, unbelievable. Does it matter? No. And so that explosive is there to shape. This phone keeps dinging. Anyway, sorry, no big deal. Is there to invert that shape charge so that you can punch through significant steel and armor. The exact thickness, oh, it's not a classified number, but it's greater than 2 inches at a certain range. So 2 inches of steel, and we're just talking regular old rolled homogeneous steel. There are other alloys, armors, and other things that I'm sure can defeat it. But 2 inches of steel, my goodness, that is thick. And so a couple of those on a target, and we're just going to say a tank for this purposes right now, could definitely do some damage if that shape charge goes into engines, the crew compartment, the ammunition compartment, the fuel compartment, you name it. So you're just trying to disable it. Also, if you, like I said, punching through the accoutrements, the laser designators, the sighting systems, closing up their hatches, it can definitely do some damage. Now, the other half of that dual purpose is anti-personnel. So not only does when that fuse goes off, super quick fuse, hits a target, immediately that charge goes off, shape charge goes through whatever it hits, but you also have the fragmentation effects of that. And the crazy thing about one M789 HEDP round is that its burst radius and general kill radius is about 4 meters. This is also where, when we talked about targeteering, so we're going to talk about one person in the open. You got one dude, one jihadi out there, who's just shooting at you, it's time to engage him. Well, when you select 30 millimeter and then you have your crosshairs, your line of sight, you put it on there, you've got the horizontal bar, and then you want him standing on that horizontal bar. And so, as an aerial weapon system, there's obviously dispersion. You're shooting from a helicopter, for crying out loud. The ballistic solution, the ballistic solution takes into account several variables. Do I remember them? Yeah. Do you really care? Maybe. You might. If you're listening to this at this point, you probably do. But I mean, we take into account the turret flexure from the first round to the third round. It applies an algorithm to understand how much the gun turret will flex, along with wind, the helicopter motion, ballistics, temperature, you name it. The helicopter filters all this so that rounds come out of the gun and land on target. Even with all that, there's just... It was designed... So, it's not a sniper rifle, that's for sure. And when every weapon system is procured, they procure it... If I can talk... And I believe this number might not be exactly accurate, but I want to say it was a 3 mil accuracy requirement. If you're a shooter, that'll make a little bit of sense to you. But essentially, if you are at 1,000 meters and you have a 3 mil accuracy requirement, you're gonna have rounds hit within a 3 meter space. Which, when you're thinking about anti-personnel vehicles, tanks, that's about the size of a tank. Which makes a lot of sense. Well, when you're trying to engage one person or a small group of people, rounds are obviously going to hit around them. Excuse me. And so it's not like a rifle where you actually have to necessarily hit the target perfectly, you know, center mass. I mean, my God, if you do with a 30 millimeter, they're done. It is, you know, do not pass go. Do not collect $200. They're done. It's it. But most likely those rounds are going to impact the ground around them. And this is where that butterfly spalling fragmentation effect takes place. And so if they're around there within about 4 meters, they're probably going to catch some frag depending on what happens to them. It just depends. But you may make them combat ineffective. So this is why the 30 millimeter shoots in a minimum burst of 10 rounds. You can select 10, 20, 30, 50 and all. You do normally shoot on most people 10 to 20 rounds. And fun fact, when I went through flight school, each round was about $50. So 10 rounds, it's a $500 trigger pull, probably more so these days. For all you shooters out there right now that are trying to find ammunition, you're like, my God. But yeah, and oftentimes you didn't just shoot one 10 round burst or one 20 round burst. You shoot till the target was stopped. And that was effective, like I said, against personnel, light-skinned vehicles, because if you've ever been to Afghanistan, seen anything about Afghanistan, or just watched anything on the news about jihadists, Taliban, etc., you've probably seen a Toyota Hilux. It's just a Tundra running around, rebranded, and they just run till the wheels fall off. You want a reliable vehicle, just go buy a Toyota. You probably don't ever have to do anything to it. Just drive it. And so that's why insurgents use Toyota vehicles. But they often mount 50 cals in the back, use them as personnel carriers to move around the battlefield from town to town, etc. And so not only is it a great hellfire target, but it's a great 30 millimeter target as well, because it just stands zero chance against 30 millimeter. Not only the shape charge, but just, I don't know how many grains a 30 millimeter weighs, but just the kinetic energy alone would just punch straight through one of those vehicles, not only just disabling it, but just destroying everything inside of it, along with the charge that goes off. So, I mean, you're talking like a small hand grenade for the most part exploding in that vehicle. So extremely good anti-personnel material effects. We've also used them to destroy enemy equipment, like rockets and mortar tubes. I've used Hellfires to do that as well. It works extremely good because, one, it's a point weapon system. You know you're going to hit it. And it also has a little more oomph behind it. You put 18,000... I keep wanting to say 18,000 pounds of high explosive. You put 18 pounds of explosive on a chunk of steel, and it's going to bend it and render it inoperable. And that's actually another story to tell one day, was when we finally blew up the Rocket Man's rocket tube and we stopped taking IDF on that deployment. Thank God. And little tangent, they actually marked this with a Taliban flag. So they have their Taliban symbol and religious writing on it. It's a white flag that they fly from a few places. I didn't see these until our last deployment. And we saw two of them that day. One marking the bunker they were shooting at us from. And so when we saw the white Taliban flag flying, we can zoom in on it and you can see it clearly. You're like, holy cow, they're marking their positions now. This is great. Clear to engage. Let's put a round on top of that. But not only that, but this rocket pod, not rocket pod, rocket tube that they're shooting Chinese 103 millimeter rockets out of had a white Taliban flag flying above it. I was like, thanks, man. Keep marking these targets with Taliban flags. We'll keep blowing them up. So we saw a few more of those at deployment. We didn't get to keep them. They don't sensitive issue as far as because it's got a lot of religious markings on it and other things like that. And I can understand that. I'm trying to remember where I was. But anyway, 30 millimeters are great for that. Hellfires are great for that. Rockets, not so much because you could shoot all day long and you might or might not hit it. That's another thing about rockets, too, is you can shoot singles, pairs, and you can ripple fire them. And that is awesome. I've done it in training. There's no real reason to do it in combat per se, unless you are just have mass troops in the open and you're really just trying to just cover an area, a lot of area. But you can, if you have two rocket pods out there full of 10 pound HE rockets, that's 36 rockets. You shoot those things on ripple fire. I mean, you're talking, you've probably seen videos of it. It's more of like a advertisement tool than it is actually an effective tool, because holding that helicopter on target to get 36 rockets out, I mean, good luck, man. And so, yeah, it's a couple things to kind of consider. So what are you shooting at? 30 is great against anti-materiel, anti-personnel. Hellfires, depending on the model missile you have, could be great anti-armor, not so good at personnel. Take the Fox Alpha or the Kilo 2 Alpha, great against anti-armor, very good against anti-personnel. Not great against culottes per se, houses, these mud houses, because there's a super quick fuse, they explode on the outside. But then, use a November model, punch through it with a thermobaric, metal augmented charge inside, extreme overpressure event, house comes down, everybody inside goes bye-bye. You know what? Let's talk about the Lima model missile here, and we'll come back to rockets. Hopefully, if I remember, we'll see. The Lima missile is one you don't see very often, and for good reasons these days. If you've ever seen an Apache, this is where the Longbow name came from, is an AH-64D model helicopter with a fire control radar on top. It looks like a giant cheese wheel. It's about a 500 pound. It's not a 500 pound paperweight, but for what we do today in Afghanistan, it might as well be. And if you've ever read anything about the Apache, you've probably heard it has fire and forget capability. Well, yes and no. With the Lima model missile, it's a radar guided missile. Yes, fire and forget. Any other Hellfire missile is a semi-active laser guided missile. So it requires you to continuously laze until impact. Otherwise, that missile's going to go somewhere. It has to have continuous guidance from the time it leaves the rail. Actually, that's not entirely true either, but we'll talk about that in a second. It has to have continuous guidance to the target. Let's say that, because you can fire a missile without lasing anything. The missile will do its G-bias climb, do its parabolic arc, and then it starts looking for laser energy. And so if you have a missile countermeasure, a countermeasure to that is to delay your lase. So say you're going up against a near-peer threat, so a modern Russian threat. They can detect the laser energy and offset it and counter that laser energy to decrease the probability of hit. So, how do you counter that? Don't lay so long. You have to laze for a few seconds prior to impact so that the missile can have terminal guidance and hit the target. But you can delay your laze for a while so that their countermeasures aren't as effective. So you're countering their countermeasures. And so that's one way to do it. We didn't have to deal with that. And in fact, it was generally a theater rule for us that we would not delay lays just because your probability of impact or probability of hit could go down. And if that missile does not find the laser energy, you don't want it going off somewhere because it's going to hit somewhere and explode. And you want that, you're responsible for that missile. So I don't think we ever did that. I did not do that in Afghanistan. Yeah. So rockets, extremely good anti-personnel. You just had to really consider civilian casualties or collateral damage, you know, damage to nearby structures, homes. And so you didn't use them in close proximity if you had a major concern about that. And for a couple things, one thing we haven't talked about with rockets, though, is overt and covert looms, because you don't always just carry a full rocket pod of 10 pound high explosive rockets. Excuse me. You would often carry a mixture. And that mixture would often include 10 pound high explosive rockets, a couple flechettes, and a couple illumination rockets, and whether or not those were overt or covert. And what I mean by that, if I say overt, is what you can imagine seeing in a movie. A rocket goes up, pops, and you have this just amazingly bright light under parachute coming down. Covert is obviously the opposite. Still an illumination rocket, but it puts out light in the IR spectrum. So if you're under night vision goggles, now you can see. If you're looking unaided with a naked eye, you'll see something, but it's extraordinarily dim compared to an overt rocket. But under night vision goggles, it looked like somebody just turned the sun on. And this was often the case. We would use these during air assaults. So if Chinooks or Blackhawks were going in, it definitely helps, especially on those darker nights when their night vision goggles don't have so much ambient light. You'd pitch the nose of the helicopter up about 3.5 kilometers away. You'd fire the rocket off. And so if you did everything right, that rocket would travel 3.5 kilometers, pop over top the HLZ, and you would have shot it high enough that it burns out prior to hitting the ground. Because one, we're not trying to set everything on fire. And two, you want the air assault to be in, landed, and done and leaving before that rocket descends into their helicopters. Probably not, because it's probably going to drift off. I'm not that good to shoot an overt illume several thousand feet in the air and then have it land on helicopters. But a few times that I've been like, hopefully this thing doesn't drift onto those helicopters. But it can happen, and it can also set things on fire. So anyway, just be considerate of that. Don't set your neighbor's places on fire with overt illumes. So depending on what the customer wanted is what we would load up and shoot. And so the other thing is if they ask for covert illumes and are under night vision goggles, dear God, please don't shoot overt illumes. Like, one quick way to have some upset customers when you do your after action reports. They're going to be like, WTF, mate. HLZ got a little bright when we went into land. Not saying it's ever been done. I've never done it. Thank God. So anyway, that is when you would choose that. And the other thing is, and this has happened, not to me, thank God, because I'm just a superior aviator, is don't shoot off a 10-pound HE rocket when you're trying to shoot illumination rounds. Because suddenly you're sitting there, you're flying, you shoot off a rocket, you're like, oh, great, that was a great illumination shot. And you never see anything, but somewhere out in the distance, you just see like a bright, quick flash. Well, that was your HE rocket that probably went several kilometers downrange and landed somewhere. So it's happened. Just select the right rockets. I was always so careful about that, because you just don't want to be that person. Oh, my goodness gracious. Anyway, a couple different things to think about when you're out. Next time you're out flying your Apache in combat, as far as what weapon systems to choose. It always kind of cracks me up, and I do. I think I'll name this podcast, like, Too Close for Missile Switching to Guns. You'll never hear anybody say that in real life. But depending on what model missile you're shooting, it might be a viable option. You get too close, you can't shoot the missile, you can still clean up the target with 30 millimeter. So, the other thing, you know what? Is often, I have never got the trifecta in an engagement. That would be somebody shooting missiles, followed by guns, followed by rockets, or missiles, rockets, and followed by guns to cover their break. But we would often, and almost always, cover our breaks off the target, because a lot of these engagements are running into the target. So you're outbound, running towards the target, and then obviously you don't want to overfly the target, because you don't want to give them your exposed belly to shoot at all day long, because they're probably pretty upset at this point, as you'd cover your break with 30 millimeter. So once the front seater saw missile impact, he would WAS, so we call WAS, action to gun, weapon action switch. And then he would continue to engage as you're turning outbound with 30 millimeter, because if anybody survived that missile blast, they're probably mad, want to know who did it, and probably want to try and shoot back at you. So best to kind of keep their heads down, cover it up. Otherwise, all right, guys, I think that might be it for today. This should be kind of cool. I hope so. Let me know what you want to hear about. I've got a few different ideas. I was going to kind of talk about maybe in next couple podcasts. Everybody always talks about their air day carry. But what I carried in combat. Because there is obviously aviation and life support gear, body armor, and beans and bullets and other things. There are a few things I carried specifically for myself. I also took a go bag. And so it might be interesting to hear what I carried in there, what my combat loadout was. It was different for everybody. There were certain things that were regimented. Things had to be in certain locations and specific to everybody, like your tourniquet had to be in a certain pocket or a pouch. And that was because if somebody needed to find your tourniquet to help you survive, they didn't want to be looking for it. But otherwise, I think that might be the next podcast. If you have something you want to hear, let me know. Excuse me. Go to Facebook, Instagram, BravoWhiskey64@gmail.com. Let me know. I'd love to hear from you. Maybe we can come up with a few more of these topics together, and I will see you at the next one. If you like the video format, let me know. It takes a long time to render video, even on a MacBook Pro, that's just unbelievable. And so audio only podcasts, I can have this thing online in the next 10 minutes, whereas the video is going to take all night to render. But if you like it, let me know. I'm going to probably continue to do it. Just because I like messing with audio and video gear. So anyway, I hope you're all doing well. If you're out there still flying, take care, fly safe. See you on the next one.